Now, even when I went to law school, which was quite some time after Dr. Chembrook, one of our first leaders has passed away, I studied Dr. Chembrook in constitutional law. Now, I was probably the only in the class that knew he was a blind guy and knew what else he had done. But Dr. Chembrook wore many, many hats. And when I found out that Dutch Chembrook would be here, I thought, well, let's have him come talk from the point of view of a family member. He was Dr. Chembrook's son, about his dad. And so we have Dutch Chembrook here. Give him a welcome for talking to us about remembrances.
Thank you, Patty. I have to start by introducing some guests that I brought with me. Wasn't sure the reception I'd get tonight, so I brought my own support team. I actually have my wife of 47 years, Kathy. Our number two son, Sean, and his bride, Edie. Our granddaughter, Dory. Our grandson, Nick, and our granddaughter, Annika. And I do thank you for the invitation. Sean teaches at Heartland Community College here in town, so we look for an excuse to come this direction. Although I have to say it's warmer in Kansas City right now. So, and so thank you, Patty, for the invitation. I'm going to jump off my script right off the bat and say, as a retired sergeant major and from the Army of 30 years, I just thank you for bringing these two young men on in front of me. And you know, these guys need our support and our thanks, and we need to continually remember to support our veterans. What I have today to share is not a strict story, if you will. It's a series of vignettes. So I'm going to move from one through the other through the next few minutes. Really, when Patty asked me to do this, I had kind of thought, not sure how to put this together. And so what I've done is I brought my grandkids here. So what I'm going to do is share little stories about their great-grandfather with them and invite you to listen in. So Dad was born in Alberta, Canada, and his father built the first frame house in Alberta province. When Dad became blind, the family moved to a farm in the San Joaquin Valley and settled in and around Layton, which is near Fresno, California. He attended the California School for the Blind, and most of you know that Dr. Newell Perry was his mentor at the school. Our first son is named Jacobus Newell Perry in his honor. Dad was about 6 feet, 3 inches tall and built like a lineman in professional football. Now, I was very interested during the student lunch to hear this line or line similar to this. My father had a very stubborn streak in that he believed there was nothing he could not do. Most of you know he was a professor at the University of California. He taught speech and political science, but is most known outside of the NFB as a constitutional lawyer. Now, many of you are aware that Dad has set the vision and standard for this organization. Most of you are unaware, however, that in the early 1950s, Dad would start a fashion trend that would catch fire in the last few years of the century. Unlike the kids of today, Dad had thought through the why. I am putting on a denim train engineer's hat. Every time Dad went out to work in the yard, he wore this hat. And he always wore it with the bill backward, covering his neck. He did it to protect his neck. I'm not sure why the kids of today do that, but I'm giving Dad the credit. I wish I could tell you where the hat came from, but I have absolutely no idea. One day when I was young, it was very hot, and I was going to jump into an ice-cold shower to cool off. Dad stopped me on the way to the shower and told me the story of being on the farm one hot day, and their china pig was making noise. Dad thought it was in distress, so he threw cold water on it, killed the pig. When I got in the shower, it was not ice cold. Dad did all the things his siblings did. He had chores on the farm, swam in the local creek, and mucked out stalls. He even liked to ride a bike. His sister tied tin cans on the strings and attached them to the backs of their bikes, and Dad would follow the sound on his bike. One day, the string on the back of Aunt Lil's bike broke and went down into a ditch, and so did Dad. I met my cousin Patty about 3 years ago, and she told me the story that every time they visited the farm, she would do her best to sneak up on Dad while he was milking the cows. She would get within about 2 feet of him, and he would say, "Patty, what are you doing?" This went on for years, and she never figured out how he knew it was her. The house I grew up in was huge. It was built on the site of an old rock crusher. It is vertical, 4 stories high, with the kitchen on the top floor and the bedrooms on the bottom 2 floors. My bedroom on the bottom floor was about 20 feet above the ground. There is some level ground on the front of the lot, but most of the lot is vertical. The quarry the rocks were mined from is at the top of the hill. Dad took one look around the living room and told the realtor, "We'll take it." The living room study area is 46 by 50 feet. It was split level with 7 steps in the middle. I remember one day Dad taught his upper level class of about 50 students with the students in the living room on the steps, Dad on a couch on the bottom floor. My brother, sister, and I used to take a cushion off a window seat in the upper level and use it to slide down the steps. The upper level is the biggest fireplace I've ever seen. The opening was about 6 feet across. I think the best way for me to describe how the house fit on the lot is to ask you imagine sitting on your bed with your pillow wrapped around you. Your pillow wraps from your left side around your back to your right side. Our house is the trunk of your body, with the majority of our lot the pillow. So the lot is basically vertical, with a flat part of the lot where your legs would be if you were sitting on your bed. In the early 1950s, the Federation was going to build an office on some of the flat space in front of our house. Many Federationists showed up one weekend to help clear the ground in the area for the new construction. The new building would be built up against the hill on the south side. There were some plane trees, which the builder had said the trees had to be trimmed way back, as plane trees are fairly weak and could have fallen on the new building. So Dad and a few folks climbed up the hill to the trees and decided they could shinny out the tree, cut off the top half, and be okay. Now, when it came time to shinny out, no one wanted to go. So Dad started making his way along the trunk. The tree itself was about 20 to 30 feet, and he was over halfway when the trunk broke behind him. Dad rode the remainder of the tree down the hill like a cowboy riding a bronco. Surprisingly, he had only a few... Wow, he's good. Surprisingly, he had only a few minor scratches and no broken bones. As he started up the hill to take care of the next tree, several bystanders and my mother stopped that idea. For treats on weekends, occasionally we would get up early, phone in our breakfast order to the King Cotton Restaurant in San Rafael, drive to Point Richmond, get on the ferry, and go to breakfast. We would spend the day in the giant redwoods or up in the Napa Valley. Dad loved the big redwoods. We had one growing right in front of our house. It was about as tall as my bedroom when I first remember it, and by the time I left home, it was taller than our house. Our morning routine was fairly simple. Dad was very disciplined. He would get up daily between 2 and 3, go to the study, and work on speeches or research. At 5:30, he would come into my bedroom and say, "Rise and shine," as he pulled the covers off of me to the bottom of the bed. That was my cue to wash up and head up 4 flights of stairs to the kitchen to help Mom prepare breakfast. Our big meal of the day was breakfast. So there was usually meat, potatoes of some kind, vegetables, and many times mom's homemade apple pie and or ice cream. After breakfast, for us it was off to school. Dad went back to the study or off to class. Evening meals for us were light fare, such as salad, soup, or sandwiches. Now, mealtime for us was like class for Dad's students. We were asked our opinions about the news of the day or significant event in school. But that was never the end of the conversation. Next, we would have to defend our opinion. Dad wanted us to reason things out, to look at both sides, and to think things through. It was a long time before I realized what a gift that was to me, my brother, and sister. We were taught never to accept, be passionate about whatever, always encouraged us to explore new things and ideas. He and Mom told us growing up that they did not care what career we chose. They did care that we became the best we could at whatever we did. By 8 p.m., Dad was in bed. On Fridays, we were allowed to sit at the end of the bed for an hour and watch Jack Benny or the Honeymooners on TV. Now, there were constantly people in our home meeting with Dad. And Annika, I was your age when there was a gentleman I used to call Mr. Earl who used to frequent our house. I learned later that Earl was his first name. Warren was his last name, and he was the governor of California and would later become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He and Dad were friends and would talk about politics and law. I think fall was one of your great-grandfather's favorite times of year. On Saturday afternoons, the adults gathered around the Grundig radio on the living room table to listen to the University of California football games. Many times, aunts and uncles would be in attendance with cocktails and cigars. Dad's favorite cigar was Behring. It came in a silver aluminum tube that my brother and I would collect and play with. Dad also followed the San Francisco 49ers and the Giants. He was a big Willie Mays fan, by the way. But the California Golden Bears were his sports passion. Holidays were a wonderful time in our family. And when you come to our house, children, look at the big roasting pan that Grandma puts the turkey in. I grew up with that pan. On Thanksgiving, there was usually a 40-pound turkey in the pan with all the trimmings and lots of pies. My brother, sister, and I were tasked with helping to prepare the pies. We had to peel 2 or 3 lugs of white astrachan apples, as well as apricots. We had 2 peeler core slicers and could take care of the apples very quickly. Astrachans have a very short season, so when the time came, we would peel several lugs, prepare them for freezing. Dad's favorite dessert was warm apple pie with vanilla ice cream. Whenever the extended family was together, there was always lively conversation, and normally that occurred around our fireplace in the living room. One of my jobs when I was in grade school was to be the popcorn popper. Once the fire was going, I would place the popcorn in a fine mesh oblong basket with a sliding top and a long handle. I would hold the basket over the fire until the corn was popped. Sometimes during the winter, Dad would suggest we cook hot dogs over the fire, and of course, we would roast marshmallows in there, too. I have to back up for a moment and talk about our freezer. I'm not sure when it arrived, but it was an 18-cubic-foot upright that was located in a room on the top floor off the dining room. It sat in an area that had been built to contain it, kind of like a big closet, but it was outside the wall of the living room. Now, back then, freezers were not frostless, so periodically I was tasked to help Dad defrost the freezer. We would get boxes to put the food in, and then we would carry pans of hot water from the kitchen and throw the water into the freezer. When the ice was gone, we would take big towels, dry it out, put the food back in, and be good for a while. I think my Uncle Len designed the room because I realized that there was a rubber pad in front of the freezer and a panel underneath it to let the water out. My Uncle Len, by the way, was the designer of the NFB office we attached to the house. Now, Nick, when I was your age, one of my jobs was to keep the woodshed full. The shed was located off the back of the living room and would hold a cord of wood vertically. Dad would cut and split the wood in the front yard, and I would carry it up 3 flights of stairs through the living room into the shed. We burned eucalyptus, which is very hard to cut and split. Dad had made a couple of saw horses to hold the logs. He had a 4-foot, 2-man crosscut saw that he used by himself until I was big enough to help. I have no idea where those logs came from, but there always seemed to be some there for Dad to cut. I later learned that friends, neighbors, and tree services would deliver the logs to Dad, and they were about 10 to 15 feet long and very heavy. Shortly after I got my driver's license, I got a lead on where we could get 20 or 30 eucalyptus tree trunks. The area had been cleared, and all we had to do was go pick them up. So we rented a truck, and Dad and I went to pick up the logs. Turned out they were all lying on a hill, and many of them were longer than 20 feet. We discovered with some effort we could roll the logs down the hill. So we parked the truck next to the hill and put some wood planks from the hill to the truck. Now, yeah, you can see it coming, can't you? We had not thought this through about how we were going to stop the logs once they got to the truck. And this we realized when we rolled the first log down the hill and it hit the truck bed just like we thought it would. And then it broke the stakes on the other side of the truck as it kept right on going. After discovering we had to walk the logs down to the truck, we managed to get them home. We worked solidly for 2 days on that project, and it is one of the few times I remember Dad complaining about being sore. It took us 3 months of weekends to get the wood cut and split. Now, those of you that are familiar with the San Francisco Bay Area, you know that you can count on one thing on Labor Day weekend: no fog. The temperature warms up, and most Labor Days are real Chamber of Commerce advertisements. For us, Labor Day meant one thing. The wooden stairs that comprised the first flight up from the ground had to be sanded and painted. Since there was no other way to get up to the front door, Dad had built a 20-foot wooden ladder to go up the wall next to the stairs. I can't remember exactly when, but I think I was in junior high when Mom put her foot down, and stairs and a path were carved into the hill next to the wall to get us up when the stairs were painted. If you continue up the hill past our kitchen, you will find the biggest eucalyptus tree I have ever seen. It was close to 50 feet tall when I left home, and about 6 feet around. Up the hill a few feet from the tree was the kids' playground. It contained a 4-foot-wide, 20-foot-long cement oval. 100 feet up a 40-degree grade was Rose, the closest street. Given the choice of carrying the material to build the playground up 4 flights of stairs and then a steep hill, or getting it down the steep grade from above, Dad did the only sensible thing. He built a 100-foot-long chute from the street above to the play area. It had 4x4 posts, was about 18 inches wide, and had 6-inch sides made of plywood. The chute was steep enough that gravel would flow down to the ground. It was still standing when I left 20 years later. About 20 feet off the playground was a 6-foot-high storm drain that the city had put in to collect the runoff from the hills above us. Dad got the city to place 8 2x4s across the culvert to keep the kids out of it. The playground was built in the early 1950s. Just before Thanksgiving of 1962, the San Francisco Bay Area received several days of record rainfall. About 7 p.m. one evening, my mom came into the room and said they needed help as water was coming in under the doors. When I got to the living room, I could see what looked like a major river coming down the hill. Water was hitting the living room door and the door on the bottom level, which had a cubbyhole set up for us to put our shoes and boots. Mom had called the fire department, and they were entering the house by climbing up on the roof of the office and then up a 15-foot ladder into my bedroom window. They then went up the house through the kitchen, past all Mom's pies, one of which mysteriously disappeared, and out the kitchen door, which was not affected by the water. Dad had figured out that debris had blocked the storm drain. And he had worked his way up the hill and gotten to the drain and was trying to clear the tree limbs and other debris. The water was so loud that Dad did not hear the firemen arrive on the scene. Dad was climbing out of the water as his hands were going numb because the water was very cold. The two firemen handed Dad a spotlight and said, "Please put the light on us so we can see what to pull out." So Dad pointed the light. Shortly, one of the firemen yelled, "Put the light over here." So Dad moved the light. The fireman responded, "No, over here." After several more tries of "put the light over here," one of the firemen got out of the water, angrily stormed over to Dad and yelled, "Are you blind? Put the light where we need it." Dad's response was, "Well, as a matter of fact." About midnight, the debris was cleared and we were able to assess the damage. When you walk out of the first floor door, out the cubbyhole, there was a 6-foot retaining wall. A part of the bottom of the wall had washed away and a huge cavern had formed underneath the walk. It was about 30 feet deep and 50 feet across. A lot of the hillside had been moved and the street in front of our house was covered in mud. The next day, we discovered that one of our neighbors, a block away down the hill, had excitedly called the fire department when she looked out her kitchen window to discover that her swimming pool was full of mud and a pair of my boots was floating upside down in the middle of the pool. That afternoon, the city sent a team to rappel down into the hole to inspect the damage. And of course, Dad had to go down to personally see what was going on. When they got back up, one of the men said to Dad, "You handle yourself very well on the ropes. Where did you get your training?" Dad's response was, "Your partner gave me instructions just before you arrived." Now, Dad loved to surprise Mom with little presents. And many times he would say, "We're going to Hinks, the local department store, to find something for Mom." I would have to describe the items for Mom, although he always wanted to see them for himself. Lots of times, he would hide the gift in my room until he was ready to give it to Mom. And he would always admonish me, "Don't clean your room. Mom will get suspicious." We spent the summers traveling, mostly to national conventions. The first car I remember was a 1954 Ford four-door sedan. It had a stick shift and no air conditioning. I remember Dad crawling all over the car, and when I got in it for our first trip, I discovered that Dad had cut a hole behind the center of the rear seat. I soon discovered, as the oldest, I was responsible for getting drinks out of the cooler that had been strategically placed right in the trunk below the hole. Pretty smart, wasn't it? As I mentioned, our car did not have air conditioning. I can't remember if it was the second or third year we had the car, but we were on our way to the convention in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Our mechanic had recommended to Mom a newfangled thing called air conditioning. This device sat over the hump between the driver and the passenger with legs that reached to the floor for stability. It plugged into the cigarette lighter. There was a tray in front of four small fans where you put ice, and the breeze blew across the ice and cooled the car. When you stopped for gas, there was a drain hose to let the water out of the bottom of the tray. It actually worked quite well, given the alternative. I think it was the second or third day on the road, Mom had to make a hard left turn into the gas station, and the water came out of the tray all over Dad's feet. He bellowed in shock and surprise. Often summer weekends, we spent with friends at Clear Lake in Northern California. Steve, Mom and Dad's friend, would take the kids up on Friday and bring us back on Sundays. One Sunday, Mom and Dad came up, and Steve suggested Dad try water skiing. Dad was up on only the third try and spent most of the afternoon on skis. When I was in the seventh grade, Dad asked if I would like to start walking with him on Sunday mornings. I jumped at the chance and said yes. And you know, I should have known better by then to ask for details, but I didn't. So needless to say, I was a little surprised when Dad woke me up at 4:30 in the morning. 3 hours later, we had walked several miles up to the top of the hills behind the university. Even though we could not see it, Dad guessed we were behind the stadium, and the quickest way to get there was down the hill. No street, no path, just eucalyptus trees and brush. After a while, we found ourselves on top of a 6-foot retaining wall behind the stadium. Of course, we jumped off, and Dad broke his cane. The following week, Dad had a 6-foot wooden broom handle instead of his cane. Now, Dad was an intense person, as most of you know. He did whatever he did full out. He worked hard and played hard. I have in our china cabinet a 20-ounce fog cutter glass from Trader Vic's. Now, so for those of you who know, a fog cutter is a rum drink. Supposedly after 2, you can cut through a pea soup fog just by opening your mouth. Mom had it and passed it on to me. The story is that Mom, Dad, Russ Kletzing, Muzzy Marcellino, I screwed that one up, didn't I? Marcellino, there we go. Perry Sundquist and their wives and a few others had gone to Trader Vic's for dinner. After dinner, the decision was made to continue drinks and conversation outside since the evening was delightful. Now, Trader Vic's did not have outside facilities at the time. So the gentlemen ordered 2 drinks apiece, placed the full drinks in their left and right suit coat pockets, paid their bills, and left. Now, Grandma and I have a large cedar chest in our house, and when Mom and Dad got ready to move to Chicago for Dad to go to law school, Mom needed something to pack her things in to ship. Dad went to Hink's department store with my Uncle Zivnuska. Dad found a chest he thought would be perfect. It was solid cedar, 5 feet long, 2 feet wide, and 2 feet high, with metal casters on the bottom. He paid $10 for it, which was a lot of money back then. Then he and my uncle picked it up and carried it home 1.5 miles. Did I mention it weighed close to 100 pounds? Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, if the weather was good, and sometimes if it was not, Dad and I would walk to school together. Berkeley High is 1 mile south of the university campus, so Dad and I would go that far together, and then I would continue on to school. I used to love to stay for a minute or so and climb up on a trash can to watch Dad walk. Now, I have to digress here for just a minute, and I'm probably the wrong person to be making these comments. Dad was 6'3". Mom was 5'1". For Dad, his normal pace was a fast trot for me when I was 10, and I eventually grew into keeping up pace with him. I never understood how Mom did it because Dad never slowed down for her. So Dad moved right along whether we were with him or he was by himself. When he was by himself, his 6-foot cane moved in a 180-degree arc with each step. So as I stood on the garbage can, I could see the crowd of students parting like the Red Sea to stay out of Dad's way. Occasionally, there were stories of bruised ankles from a student who was not paying attention. And I can only imagine what the stories would be today with kids buried in their phones. So I must include a couple of stories of Dad in the classroom, the 2 most famous, if you will. Dad's first class was always at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It was a freshman-sophomore class that was always wait-listed and booked full. Dad was in the middle of a lecture, and 2 students in the back of the room were passing a paper back and forth. Dad stopped his lecture and asked if tic-tac-toe were more important than the information he was presenting. There was silence in the back of the room as the student with the paper held it up for everyone to see. They were, in fact, playing tic-tac-toe. The second story is that Dad was teaching when a student walked in late. The student apologized for the interruption and headed to his seat. Dad resumed teaching and stopped to ask the student when he started walking on 4 feet. A second student was walking behind the first one, mimicking his steps. Apparently not well enough. As a youngster, I thought San Francisco International Airport was our second home. It seems we spent a lot of time there taking and picking up Dad. Now, I know you're thinking, well, you were young, and it may have seemed that way, but probably not. Dad flew mostly on United Airlines, and the counter crew, ground crews, and many of the flight crews knew him. My brother, sister, and I were on a roster for taking Dad onto the plane and getting him off. Now, I have to say, this is pre-automated gangways at the airport. So Dad was always boarded first, and then we got to take him onto the plane and then get off so the plane could board. Getting Dad off the flight was the most fun. The ground crew would come and get us, and we got to help put the stairs in place and then be there when the door was opened. When the automated walkways were brought in, we were allowed to drive it up to the airplane to meet Dad. As long as I can remember, off sitting, and most of the times he was standing at the door when it was opened. If you have listened to Dad's speeches, he was a very good orator. One morning, shortly after President Kennedy had been inaugurated, Mom told me that Uncle Len and Aunt Betty were coming to stay with us for a few days, as Dad had been called to Washington to coach the president in speech-making. In 1964, I joined the Army and was sent to Germany in January of 1965. The first week in November of 1965, Mom and Dad came to visit me in Nuremberg, Germany. They had been traveling over Europe to meet with contacts to get the International Federation of the Blind off the ground. And since they were close, they came to spend 4 days with me. So it was at the end of a three-week overseas trek, I met them at the airport, and Mom handed me a frozen homemade apple pie. She had asked every flight crew and every hotel they were in to put it in the freezer, and they did. I warmed it on the radiator in my barracks room, and my roommates and I really enjoyed it. While they were there, we explored the sights and enjoyed some really good food and beer. Now, it's cold in Germany in November, so we found Dad a Russian-style fur hat, and he wore that hat for a long, long time. Dad also wanted to buy a Grundig radio, and we found a little shop in the middle of old Nuremberg and went in. An older gentleman came out from the back of the shop to assist us, and he spent about a half an hour explaining the different features of the radios and helping Dad to pick the one he wanted. Dad finally made his choice, and the gentleman pulled out his sales pad to write up the sale. I gave him my name when he asked. He then asked my address, and when I answered, he took a step back and said under his breath, SS, and walked to the back of the shop. A short time later, his son came out to finish the transaction. Dad asked what was wrong, and the young man explained that during the war, the place where I was stationed was used by the SS, and his fathers assumed the Americans used it for the same purpose. Dad was taken aback and later said he had not considered that perspective and was actually surprised he didn't encounter it more. Now, for you college kids, this one's for you. Dad loved pizza of a particular kind. We would go as a family to a little place on Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley called Giovanni's. Dad would order a pitcher of beer, and the kids, that was us, fought over the toppings for their medium pizza. Dad would get pepperoni on French bread, which was half a loaf of sourdough French bread as the pizza base. The last time we ate there, I got the same thing as Dad, and it quickly became my favorite too. You know, Dad was indeed a man of vision, and you are proof of that. More than that, he brought passion into everything he did. From teaching class to eating pizza, he challenged us to be all we can, to push our limits every day, to continually learn and stretch our capabilities. He frequently told me he didn't care what I became when I grew up, as long as I was the best at everything I did. I would say his challenge lives on today as you reach out for improved lives and opportunities. I appreciate the opportunity to share these few memories with you. Thank you very much. Thanks, Patty.
Now, Dutch, I only got to know your dad through his writings. I did know your mom, though, because she lived on past him for quite a while. Can you talk a little bit about your mom?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, your mom was amazing.
Well, and the kids, Dory and Nick, some got to remember their great-grandmother because we moved her to Kansas for the last 5 years of her life. Was the probably the best thing for her we had a great time with her. Mom loved to eat, was a great fan of Guinness. Yeah. Was a tremendous football fan. Yes, I have to tell you, we actually got the doctor to write a prescription when she was in the nursing home. And every evening, we bought Mom a recliner. We called it her throne in the nursing home. So after dinner, Mom would sit in her throne and watch TV, and the nurse would come in, open a Guinness, put a straw in it, and Mom would drink it. So, but absolutely, Mom and Dad had a tremendously deep relationship. You may or may not know that they eloped because Mom's parents didn't approve of Dad. So they actually eloped to Reno and got married.
Why didn't they approve?
Because of his blindness, absolutely. But Mom was an equal partner with Dad and was literally his right hand. But she was, for her own sake, had a tremendously stubborn streak. Yeah.
I said that I saw.
But I can say that all the way up to the end had a tremendous love for the NFB and for the work that she and Dad created and shared that vision with him and was tremendously supportive of all the efforts across the board of that. She was just a neat lady right up to the end. Her one... I guess regret, I would say, the thing that ticked her off about me is in the 4 years she was with us, we never had a really good snowstorm in Kansas City, and she was dying to go sledding with the great grandkids. So that was it.
Many people also don't know that the one place that did initially hire Dr. Timber, because he talks in some of his speeches about how hard it was to get hired, and I'm very proud to say that was the University of Chicago Law School. And Dutch's mom was at a number of NFB events when I first joined, and she was really one of the women that I looked up to most, because her personality, I have a little bit of stubborn streak too. So who, me? So, you know, I just enjoyed your mom immensely. Do people have questions? Jamal, and I don't have a lot of time for him, but Jamal, can we get Jamal a mic? And that was lovely, Dutch, really. Somebody, thank you.
Well, this is going to be hard since I didn't bring any answers.
Okay. Mr. Timbrook, first of all, nice presentation. And your father was a very great man. With that being said, I've heard a lot of people discuss some of your dad's past writings, both on disability law and constitutional policy, and his work founding the NFB. And I've heard a lot of people say that your father today would have been considered a pretty progressive fellow. Would you agree with that? With those assertions?
No.
Why not?
Well, the world has changed so much in the last 50 years that what is progressive today was not progressive back then. Although I can tell you that there's a picture in a newspaper that was often credited to Dad was reading a speech during the start of the free speech movement at the University of California, and the caption says it was a student, he was reading a speech off a student's head. That was actually me. I was on leave in civilian clothes, because of course you couldn't be in uniform doing that kind of thing. But even though Dad was essentially in the group of four professors that started the free speech movement at the University of California, I don't think today he would actually qualify as a progressive.
I think what's most interesting about Dr. Timbrook for me is that he wasn't focused on blindness. Many of his writings are about poverty and race and disability. He really did help develop 14th Amendment jurisprudence. And for those of you that don't know, it looks like from his letters he had some impact on Thurgood Marshall's brief in the Brown v. Board of Ed case. Any other questions? Thank you, Dutch. That was lovely. And welcome, Kathy, and the whole family.
Okay.
Oh, you are back. Okay. Yeah. Now, are the kids coming?